chopping block for me. Many thousand gone.
Hi, you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia on the 29th of May, 2013. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another show. My name's Harrywood Fenton. The music there I'm playing, a bit of a break from our usual intro music. That's Bob Dylan singing No More Auction Block, an old anti-slavery song. And it's a song of liberation. And I'd like to reflect for a moment on the question of slavery and what it really means to be free in this show. Slavery, of course, is a condition which has been quite common around the world since the dawn of civilization, a situation where people are considered to be the property of other people. And it's probably the symbol of oppression that is the most powerful and leads to the worst kind of abuses of human beings. There's something about the concept of a person being the property of another person which seems to indeed engender violence and abuse and sadistic levels of abuse like no other. It seems to actually bring out the worst in people. You create a situation where people become essentially slaves to others, and it tends to engender incredible violence. It tends to bring out some dark side of human nature. Of course, we see that in prison systems. We've seen it in some of the psychological experiments that have been done to investigate what actually takes place in prisons. And there's a famous experiment known as the Stanford Prison Experiment, which highlighted the tendency of human beings to slip in to this rather extreme form of behavior. And I want to talk a little bit about that in today's show. Also in today's show, I want to bring you some more news on vaccines. And I've got some interesting audio clips to play to you, some interviews with the famous and defamed expert and doctor Andrew Wakefield, which explain some of the reasons why he's qualified and what he has to say about it more recently in regard to the MMR vaccine. I also want to talk to you a little bit about Chappelle Corby, some news in relation to her. It's been a long wait there for her family. There have been offers of clemency from the Indonesian government, but she is still behind bars and there is still no end in sight for Chappelle Corby. I want to talk to you a little bit about, again, on the vaccine front, what is actually happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan, because there a number of people are actually taking violent action against vaccine workers. And I mentioned this on last week's show, but it's an indication that many people are beginning to wake up to perhaps the darker side of what the World Health Organization and other NGOs like USAID are up to in places like Afghanistan. I also have an open letter to the Transport Minister, Anthony Albanese, about body scanners, and an article that was published in the Civil Liberties Australia website. And it's quite a passionate and really well-written article there about the affront to human rights posed by airport body scanners. And we have some news from the Syrian conflict, which I believe is quite important, that the Russian government has determined that it will send the S-300 missile defense technology to Syria, which is going to make it extremely difficult for any foreign country to launch an attack against Syria. And I think that's a very, very interesting development. So do stay with us for all this and more on Truth News Radio Australia. We are located on the internet at www.truthnews.com.au, and you can get our streaming show on Logos Radio Network, and you can get that every week. So just visit us at truthnews.com.au, and you can get all of our information and all of our shows. We have voices. Now, I'd like to draw your attention to a book titled The Lucifer Effect by Philip Zimbardo. And there is a website, www.lucifereffect.com. And just reading here from the website, this is from the author, Philip Zimbardo. In this book, I summarize more than 30 years of research on factors that can create a perfect storm, which leads good people to engage in evil actions. This transformation of human character is what I call the Lucifer effect, named after God's favorite angel, Lucifer, who fell from grace and ultimately became Satan. Rather than providing a religious analysis, however, I offer a psychological account of how ordinary people sometimes turn evil and commit unspeakable acts. As part of this account, the Lucifer Effect tells, for the first time, the full story behind the Stanford Prison Experiment and our classic study I conducted in 1971. In that study, normal college students were randomly assigned to play the role of guard or inmate for 2 weeks in a simulated prison. Yet the guards quickly became so brutal that the experiment had to be shut down after only 6 days. How and why did this transformation take place? And what does it tell us about recent events such as the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuses in Iraq? Equally important, what does it say about the nature of human nature, and what does it suggest about effective ways to prevent such abuses in the future? Please join me in a journey that the poet Milton might describe as making a darkness visible. Although it is often hard to read about evil up close and personal, we must understand its causes in order to contain and transform it through wise decisions and innovative communal actions. Indeed, in my view, there is no more urgent task that faces us today. Now, I agree wholeheartedly with what Philip Zimbardo says there about the urgency of the task. But I also believe that the question about evil is tied to the question about human freedom and the potential for enslavement, because I do believe that the type of evil that he talks about in his books is the same type of evil that I talk about when I talk about the condition of slavery or the condition of tyranny, which we've found in human societies from time to time, sometimes to a greater or lesser extent, and which I believe we're now seeing on the rise in Western so-called democracies. I actually believe that the condition of slavery engenders the unique type of evil that we've seen in extreme forms, for example, in the Abu Ghraib prisons or in Auschwitz, and I could reel off dozens of other examples. But when you have this tendency towards people becoming the property of other people, or certain people being given the power over prisoners to treat as if they were their property, the evil becomes manifest. But I want to continue with Philip Zimbardo because I think his research is actually really interesting. And I want to play to you a short speech here he gave at a TED talk titled The Psychology of Evil.
Philosophers, dramatists, theologians have grappled with this question for centuries. What makes people go wrong? Interestingly, I asked this question when I was a little kid. When I was a kid growing up in the South Bronx, inner city ghetto in New York, I was surrounded by evil, as all kids are who grow up in an inner city. And I had friends who were really good kids who lived out the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde scenario of Robert Louis Stevenson. That is, they took drugs, got in trouble, went to jail, some got killed. And some did it without drug assistance. So when I read Robert Louis Stevenson, that was in fiction. The only question is, what was in the juice? And more importantly, that line between good and evil, which privileged people like to think is fixed and impermeable, with them on the good side and the others on the bad side, I knew that line was immovable and it was permeable. Good people could be seduced across that line, and on some rare circumstances, bad kids could recover with help, with reform, with rehabilitation. So I want to begin with this wonderful illusion by Swiss artist M.C. Escher. If you look at it and focus on the white, what you see is a world full of angels. But let's look more deeply. And as we do, what appears is the demons, the devils in the world. And that tells us several things. One, the world will always be filled with good and evil, because good and evil is the yin and yang of the human condition. It tells me something else, if you remember. God's favorite angel was Lucifer. Apparently, Lucifer means the light. It also means the morning star in some scripture. And apparently, he disobeyed God, and that's the ultimate disobedience to authority. And when he did, Michael the archangel was sent to kick him out of heaven along with the other fallen angels. And so Lucifer descends into hell, becomes Satan, becomes the devil. The force of evil in the universe begins. Paradoxically, it was God who created hell as a place to store evil. He didn't do a good job of keeping it there, though. So this arc of the cosmic transformation of God's favorite angel into the devil, for me, sets the context for understanding human beings who are transformed from good, ordinary people into perpetrators of evil. So the Lucifer effect, although it focuses on the negatives that people can become, not the negatives that people are, leads me to a psychological definition. Evil is the exercise of power, and that's the key, it's about power, to intentionally harm people psychologically, to hurt people physically, to destroy people mortally or ideas, and to commit crimes against humanity.
We're just going to break. I think he made a very important point there about the exercise of power, and that relates back to what I've been saying here all along about how the control of others is essential to the type of evil we're talking about. We're just going to break. We'll be right back after this. Do stay with us. You're with Truth News.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Seems to me like they want us to be afraid, man. Maybe we just like being afraid. Maybe we just so used to it at this point that it's just a part of us. Part of our culture. Security alert on orange. It's been on orange since 01, G. I mean, what's up, man? Can a brother get yellow, man? Just for like 2 months or something? Goddamn. Sick of that. Mic check. The groove is thick, so I'ma rhyme like a lunatic. I do this shit with an unassuming wit. The corporation conjured up the bass and the tempo. My name is Liv, that's the intro, now let's go. The flow of life throwing strife into the mix to the pick.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm playing to you a clip here from Philip Zimbardo, author of The Lucifer Effect and creator of the famous Stanford Prison Experiment from the 1970s. And he's talking here about evil at a TED conference. So I'll just continue here from where I left off before the break.
If you Google evil, a word that should surely have withered by now, you come up with 136 million hits in a third of a second. A few years ago, I'm sure all of you were shocked, as I was, with the revelation of American soldiers abusing prisoners in a strange place in a controversial war, Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And these were men and women who were putting prisoners through unbelievable humiliation. I was shocked, but I wasn't surprised, because I had seen those same visual parallels when I was the prison superintendent of the Stanford Prison Study. Immediately, the Bush administration military said what? What all administrations say when there's a scandal: don't blame us, it's not the system, it's the few bad apples, the few rogue soldiers. My hypothesis is American soldiers are good, usually. Maybe it was the barrel that was bad. But how am I going to deal with that hypothesis? I became an expert witness for one of the guards, Sergeant Chip Frederick, and in that position, I had access to the dozen investigative reports. I had access to him. I could study him, have him come to my home, get to know him, do psychological analysis to see, was he a good apple or a bad apple? And thirdly, I had access to all of the 1,000 pictures that these soldiers took. These pictures are of a violent or sexual nature. All of them come from the cameras of American soldiers. Because everybody has a digital camera, a cell phone camera, they took pictures of everything, more than 1,000. What I've done is I organized them into various categories, but these are by United States military police, army reservists. They are not soldiers prepared for this mission at all. And it all happened in a single place, Tier 1A, on the night shift. Why? Tier 1A was the center for military intelligence. It was the interrogation hold. CIA was there, interrogators from Titan Corporation, all there, and they're getting no information about the insurgency. So they're going to put pressure on these soldiers, military police, to cross the line, give them permission to break the will of the enemy, to prepare them for interrogation, to soften them up, to take the gloves off. Those are the euphemisms. And this is
now, at this point, the video gives way to a number of images taken from the Abu Ghraib prison. And I will be providing this on the website. It's on YouTube. Some images you've probably seen before. There's quite a few there that I hadn't seen before. Really, really disturbing images. Really heartbreaking, really chilling examples of utter human depravity. And, of course, this was done under the watch of the US government during the occupation of Iraq. Now I'll just fast forward to the continuation of Dr. Zimbardo's presentation.
So pretty horrific. That's one of the visual illustration of evil. And it should not have escaped you that the reason I paired the prisoner with his arms out with Leonardo da Vinci's Ode to Humanity is that that prisoner was mentally ill. That prisoner covered himself with shit every day, and they used to have to roll him in dirt so he wouldn't stink. But the guards ended up calling him shit boy. What was he doing in that prison rather than in some mental institution? In any event, here's former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. He comes down and says, I want to know who is responsible. Who are the bad apples? Well, that's a bad question. You have to reframe it and ask, what is responsible? Because what could be the who of people, but it could also be the what of the situation, and obviously that's where I'm headed. So how do psychologists go about understanding such transformations of human character if you believe that they were good soldiers before they went down to that dungeon? There are three ways. The main way is what's called dispositional. We look at what's inside of the person, the bad apples. This is the foundation of all of social science, the foundation of religion, the foundation of law. Social psychologists like me come along and say, yeah, people are the actors on the stage, but you'll have to be aware of what the situation is. Who are the cast of characters? What's the costume? Is there a stage director? And so we're interested in what are the external factors around the individual, the bad barrel. And social scientists stop there, and they miss the big point that I discovered when I became an expert witness for Abu Ghraib. The power is in the system. The system creates the situation that corrupts the individuals. The system is the legal, political, economic, cultural background. And this is where the power is of the bad barrel makers. So you want to change a person, you got to change the situation. You want to change the situation, you got to know where the power is in the system. So the Lucifer effect involves understanding human character transformations with these three factors. And it's a dynamic interplay. What do the people bring into the situation? What does the situation bring out of them? And what is the system that creates and maintains that situation? So my book, The Lucifer Effect, recently published, is about how do you understand how good people turn evil, and it has a lot of detail about what I'm going to talk about today. So Dr. Z's Lucifer Effect, although it focuses on evil, really is a celebration of the human mind's infinite capacity to make any of us kind or cruel, caring or indifferent, creative or destructive, and it makes some of us villains, and the good news story that I'm going to hopefully come to at the end is it makes some of us heroes. This is a wonderful cartoon in The New Yorker, which really summarizes my whole talk. I'm neither a good cop nor a bad cop, Jerome. Like yourself, I'm a complex amalgam of positive and negative personality traits that emerge or not depending on the circumstances. This is a study some of you think you know about, but very few people have ever read the story. You watched the movie. This is Stanley Milgram, little Jewish kid from the Bronx, and he asked the question, could the Holocaust happen here, now? People said, no, that's Nazi Germany, that's Hitler. You know, that's 1939. He said, yeah, but suppose Hitler asked you, would you electrocute a stranger? No way, not me, I'm a good person. He said, why don't we put you in a situation and give you a chance to see what you would do? And so what he did was he tested 1,000 ordinary people, 500 New Haven, Connecticut, 500 Bridgeport, and the ad said, psychologists want to understand memory, we want to improve people's memory, because memory is a key to success, okay? We're going to give you $5, $4 for your time. And he said, we don't want college students, we want men between 20 and 50, in the latest studies they ran women, ordinary people, barbers, clerks, white collar people. So you go down, and one of you is going to be a learner, one of you is going to be a teacher. The learner is a genial middle-aged guy. He gets tied up to the shock apparatus in another room. The learner could be this middle-aged, could be as young as 20. And one of you is told by the authority, the guy in the lab coat, your job as teacher is to give this guy material to learn. Gets it right, reward him. Gets it wrong, you press a button on the shock box. First button is 15 volts. He doesn't even feel it. That's the key. All evil starts with 15 volts. And then the next step is another 15 volts. The problem is, at the end of the line is 450 volts. And as you go along, the guy is screaming, I've got a heart condition, I'm out of here. You're a good person, you complain. Sir, who's going to be responsible if something happens to him? Experiment says, don't worry, I will be responsible. Go, continue, teacher. And the question is, who would go all the way to 450 volts? You should notice here, when it gets up to 375, it says danger, severe shock. When it gets up to here, there's triple X, the pornography of power. So Milgram asked 40 psychiatrists, what percent of American citizens would go to the end? They said only 1%, because that's sadistic behavior, and we know, psychiatry knows, only 1% of Americans are sadistic. Okay, here's the data. They could not be more wrong. Two-thirds go all the way to 450 volts. This was just one study. Milgram did more than 16 studies. And look at this. In study 16, where you see somebody like you go all the way, 90% go all the way. In study 5, if you see people rebel, 90% rebel. What about women? Study 13, no different than men. So Milgram is quantifying evil as to the willingness of people to blindly obey authority, to go all the way to 450 volts. And it's like a dial on human nature. A dial in the sense that you can make almost everybody totally obedient, down to the majority, down to none. So what are the external parallels? All research is artificial. What's the validity in the real world? 912 American citizens committed suicide or were murdered by family and friends in Guyana jungle in 1978 because they were blindly obedient to this guy, their pastor, not the priest, their pastor, Reverend Jim Jones. He persuaded them to commit mass suicide. And so he's the modern Lucifer effect, a man of God who becomes the angel of death. Milgram's study is all about individual authority to control people. Most of the time, we are in institutions. So the Stanford Prison Study is a study of the power of institutions to influence individual behavior.
You've been listening there to a TED Talk by Philip Zimbardo on the psychology of evil. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, which is going to break. Stay with us.
Could be your best friend. Ooh.
Welcome back. You're tuned to Truth News Radio. Looking here about the psychology of evil and the abuse of power, and I'm framing that for my purposes today by proposing to you that human freedom is essential as a safeguard against the type of evil that Philip Zimbardo is describing in his experiments. Everything that occurred in Zimbardo's experiment and also in the Stanley Milgram experiment occurred within a context where people had been trained to completely subordinate their free will to authority, to trust authority, but to the point of effacing their own decision-making and moral compass. And that's a type of slavery. That's a loss of freedom. When you look at what happened in the Abu Ghraib prison, these were soldiers who were within a very, very strict, rigidly controlled paradigm of the US military, and then given complete power over helpless victims. The power and the abuse of power is transferred down from one level to the next level to the next level. So I may have a slightly different take on this to Philip Zimbardo, but he has spent most of his life studying this, so I would certainly respect what he has to say. So let us just now continue with the Psychology of Evil TED Talk by Philip Zimbardo.
Interestingly, Stanley Milgram and I were in the same high school class in James Monroe in the Bronx, 1954. So this study, which I did with my graduate students, especially Craig Haney, we also began with an ad. We didn't have money, so we had a cheap little ad. But we wanted college students for a study of prison life. 75 people volunteered, took personality tests, we did interviews, picked 24, most normal, most healthy, randomly assigned them to be prisoner and guard. So on day one, we knew we had good apples, I'm going to put them in a bad situation, and secondly, we know there's no difference between the boys who are going to be guards, the boys who are going to be prisoners. The kids who are going to be prisoners just said, wait at home in the dormitories, the study will begin Sunday. We didn't tell them that the city police were going to come and do realistic arrests.
Police car pulls up in front, and a cop comes to the front door and knocks and says he's looking for me. So they, right there, they took me out the door, they put my hands against the car. It was a real cop car, it was a real policeman, and there were real neighbors in the street who didn't know that I was, this was a experiment. And there was cameras all around and neighbors all around. But they put me in the car, then they drove me around Palo Alto. They took me to the police station, the basement of the police station. Then they put me in a cell. I was the first one to be picked up, so they put me in a cell, which was just like a room with a door with bars on it. You could tell it wasn't a real jail. They locked me in there in this degrading little outfit. They were taking this experiment too seriously.
Here are the prisoners who are going to be dehumanized. They're going to become numbers. Here are the guards with the symbols of power and anonymity. Guards get prisoners to clean the toilet bowls out their bare hands, to do other humiliating tasks. They strip them naked. They sexually taunt them. They begin to do degrading activities, like having them simulate sodomy. You saw simulating fellatio in soldiers in Abu Ghraib. My guards did it in 5 days. The stress reaction was so extreme that normal kids we picked because they're healthy had breakdowns within 36 hours. The study ended after 6 days because it was out of control. 5 kids had emotional breakdowns. Does it make a difference if warriors go to battle, changing their appearance or not? Does it make a difference if they're anonymous and how they treat their victims? We know in some cultures they go to war, they don't change appearance. In other cultures, they paint themselves like Lord of the Flies. In some, they wear masks. In many, they wear soldiers are anonymous in uniform. So with this anthropologist, John Watson, found 23 cultures that had 2 bits of data. Do they change their appearance? 15. Do they kill, torture, mutilate? 13. If they don't change their appearance, only 1 of 8 kills, torture, mutilate. The key is in the red zone. If they change their appearance, 12 of 13, that's 90%, kill, torture, mutilate. And that's the power of anonymity. So what are the seven social processes that grease the slippery slope of evil? Mindlessly taking the first small step. Dehumanization of others. Deindividuation of self. Diffusion of personal responsibility. Blind obedience to authority. Uncritical conformity to group norms. Passive tolerance of evil through inaction or indifference. And it happens when you're in a new or unfamiliar situation. Your habitual response patterns don't work. Your personality and morality are disengaged. Nothing is easier than to denounce the evildoer. Nothing more difficult than understanding him, Dostoevsky tells us. Understanding is not excusing. Psychology is not excusiology. So social psychological research reveals how ordinary good people can be transformed without the drugs. You don't need it. You just need the social psychological processes. Real world parallels. Compare this with this. James Schlesinger, and I'm going to have to end with this, says, psychologists have attempted to understand how and why individuals and groups who usually act humanely can sometimes act otherwise in certain circumstances. That's the Lucifer effect. And he goes on to say, the landmark Stanford study provides a cautionary tale for all military operations. If you give people power without oversight, it's a prescription for abuse. They knew that and let that happen. So another report, investigative report by General Fay, says the system is guilty. And in this report he says, it was the environment created Abu Ghraib by leadership failures that contributed to the occurrence of such abuse. And the fact that it remained undiscovered by higher authorities for a long period of time. Those abuses went on for 3 months. Who was watching the store? The answer is nobody. I think nobody on purpose. He gave the guards permission to do those things and they knew nobody was ever going to come down to that dungeon. So you need a paradigm shift in all of these areas. The shift is away from the medical model that focuses only on the individual. And the shift is toward a public health model that recognizes situational and systemic vectors of disease. Bullying is a disease. Prejudice is a disease. Violence is a disease. And since the Inquisition, we've been dealing with problems at the individual level. And you know what? It doesn't work. Alexander Solzhenitsyn says the line between good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. That means that line is not out there. That's a decision that you have to make. That's a personal thing. So I want to end very quickly on a positive note. Heroism as the antidote to evil. By promoting the heroic imagination, especially in our kids, in our educational system, we want kids to think, I'm a hero in waiting, waiting for the right situation to come along, and I will act heroically. My whole life is now going to focus away from evil that I've been in since I was a kid to understanding heroes. The banality of heroism is it's ordinary people who do heroic deeds. It's the counterpoint to Hannah Arendt's banality of evil. Our traditional societal heroes are wrong because they are the exception. They organize their whole life around this. That's why we know their names. And our kids' heroes are also wrong models for them because they have supernatural talents. We want our kids to realize most heroes are everyday people. And the heroic act is unusual. This is Joe Darby. He was the one that stopped those abuses you saw because when he saw those images, he turned them over to a senior investigating officer. He was a low-level private, and that stopped it.
Now, I'll just leave it there. I think what he's just said there illustrates, I think, my point better than I could have said it, which is that it is the essential quality of your freedom that allows you to short-circuit the pattern of evil. The man that he was referring to there, Darby, who blew the whistle on the Abu Ghraib abuses, he exercised his freedom. Bradley Manning, who leaked the famous footage of the massacre in Baghdad in 2007 and is now in a military dungeon, exercised his freedom. But there is often a huge cost to pay for those who exercise their freedom to stop abuse, to stop enslavement, to stop evil. And it's not as simple as just saying, well, we've got to teach our kids to do this. It takes a lot of courage. And I say this very sincerely in relation to some really, really serious problems we've got developing in our society right now. And I'm going to be returning to the vaccine topic again after the break, because with the government and media and pharmaceutical cartels pressing for mandatory vaccination, we have a situation where, in fact, we have to become heroic. It is incumbent upon us to be heroic. We will slip slide into the sort of darkness that Philip Zimbardo is talking about. And the vaccine issue is just one issue. There are many, many others. We have to be heroes. You're with Truth News Radio. I'll be right back after this break. Stay with me. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. And I've been talking about the psychology of evil, and I've been talking about the necessity for some of us to be heroes. Preferably all of us. The higher the percentage, the better. Some of us are going to have to be heroes. And what does it mean to be a hero? Well, as Philip Zimbardo was saying there, it's an ordinary capability. If you're free. And that's my addendum. He didn't say that. I'm saying that. If you're not free, if you are caught in the authoritarian paradigm, and so many people are, even they're not even aware of it, but they're caught in that paradigm. They cannot think for themselves. They cannot act for themselves. They constantly turn to a higher authority to tell them what to think, to tell them what is legitimate, what is not legitimate, to give them permission to do things. This condition is incompatible with being a hero. You cannot be a hero if you're in that condition. I want to give you an example now of another hero, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who I mentioned last week on the show and I've often referred to on this show. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, the author of a groundbreaking study which showed very disturbing links between the MMR vaccine and autism, who suffered a complete destruction of his career, vilification in the media, is an example of what you have to be when you challenge abuses of power. And vaccines are an abuse of power. And I really wish that when we're debating this with people who don't understand it, people who are new to the subject, that we could get off this endless merry-go-round of questions and doubts about whether this vaccine works or whether that vaccine works, whether they are 100% good, whether some of them are good, whether the whole science of immunization is good or bad. Those are all really important questions, right? And I'm not diminishing those questions. But those questions continually distract from the fundamental, clear, absolutely blazingly crystal clear question about human freedom. Because the argument that is continually being used is that you must obey. You must obey. You must conform. You must subordinate yourself to the decisions of the authorities, which is for the greater good. And those statements, those imperatives, those declarations that are made are then backed up by some science that says, well, this vaccine is good. Oh, this vaccine is good, therefore we're going to force you to take it. No, hang on. If a medicine is good, I will take a look, I'll research it, and, you know, if I like that medicine, I'll take it. If I don't like it, I won't take it. And I won't give it to my kids either, because I am in charge of my kids. I'm responsible for my kids. I'm the guardian, the legal guardian of my kids, right? The state isn't. I am. I have to make the decisions. just because something is good is not a reason why I have to partake of it. But that is the argument that is used with vaccines, but it is also the argument that is used with any form of tyranny, any form of unilateral decision-making that's made from above. They say it's good for you. And what's the key signature of that? What's the key signature of it? It's about power. It's about you being a slave and a structure above you, run by individuals who perhaps themselves are slaves too, to that system. But it's about the system itself enslaving you. And that's what we have to fight against. We don't even have to argue about whether the vaccines really work or not, as much as I want to, and I think it's important. But we've got to understand, what we really have to fight against is power for the sake of power. And what we have to assert is freedom for the sake of freedom, because freedom is the antidote to all forms of evil. That's what I believe. I'm going to start a little video here from Dr. Wakefield, where he talks about a bit of background about measles in particular. Now, measles, the measles vaccine was one which he actually said should have been separated from the MMR. The MMR is measles, mumps, rubella. And he actually had suggested in his paper, which was later retracted by The Lancet, that the measles vaccine should be available as a separate vaccine. And you'll see, he'll describe it for you, what the result of that was. You see, many people did become concerned about the MMR vaccine. Vaccination levels did drop a little, but the measles vaccine was never made available as a single vaccine. Anyway, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Wakefield from this point, and you can reflect on what a true hero and a true whistleblower would do.
Good morning. The first thing that I want to say is that I did not seek out this latest media maelstrom. It came about because of an outbreak of measles in South Wales, in the United Kingdom, for which I had been blamed by Her Majesty's government. So I did not seek this out, but now it seems that I have been denied the opportunity to redress the allegations that have been made against me by members of the government, by members of public health, and that is clearly unacceptable. So legitimate debate about the safety of MMR vaccine and the origin of the measles epidemic in Wales have now been effectively blocked by the government insisting that the British media do not give me airtime, do not allow me to respond, and that is the purpose of this. So I did not start this current fight. The important thing to say is that back in 1996, 97, I was made aware of children developing autism, regressive autism, following exposure, in many cases, to the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Such was my concern about the safety of that vaccine that I went back and reviewed every safety study, every pre-licensing study of the MMR vaccine and other measles-containing vaccines before they were put into children and after. And I was appalled with the quality of that science. It really was totally below par, and that has been reiterated by other authoritative sources since. I compiled my observations into a 200-page report, which I am seeking to put online once I get the permission of my lawyers. And that report was the basis of my impression that MMR vaccine was inadequately tested for safety, certainly compared with the single vaccines, and therefore that was the basis of my recommendation in 1998 at the press conference that parents should have the option of the single vaccines. All I could do as a parent is to say, what would I do for my child? That was the only honest answer I could give. My position on that has not changed. So, what happened subsequently? At that time, the single measles vaccines, the single vaccines were available freely on the National Health Service. Otherwise, I would not have suggested that option. So parents, if they were legitimately concerned about the safety of MMR, could go and get the single vaccines. 6 months later, the British government unilaterally withdrew the importation license for the single vaccines, therefore depriving parents of having these on the NHS, depriving parents who have legitimate concerns about the safety of MMR from a choice, denying them the opportunity to protect their children in the way that they saw fit. And I was astonished by this, and I said to Dr. Elizabeth Miller of the Health Protection Agency, why would you do this? If your principal concern is to protect children from serious infectious disease, why would you remove an option from parents who are legitimately concerned about the safety of MMR? And her answer was extraordinary. She said to me, if we allow parents the option of single vaccines, it would destroy our MMR program. In other words, her concern, her principal concern, seemed to be for protection of the MMR program and not for protection of children. Now, were parents' concerns about the safety of MMR legitimate? Did they have a reason to be concerned? The answer is unequivocally yes. When the MMR was introduced in the UK in the late 1980s, there were three brands that were introduced. Two of those three brands had to be withdrawn hurriedly 4 years later because they were causing meningitis in children at an unacceptable rate. In other words, two-thirds of the licensed vaccines in the UK had to be removed from circulation because they were dangerous. And what is very disturbing about this, and this was brought to my attention by a government whistleblower, Dr. Alistair Torres, who was working at that time for the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, the regulatory body in the UK. He made it clear to the British government that they should not use those dangerous vaccines. He made it clear to that committee prior to the licensing of the MMR in 1987. Why? Because he was brought in from Canada, where they were already having problems with this vaccine under the name of Trivirix, the identical vaccine that was introduced in the UK under the name Pluserix. And there they had noticed that there were cases of meningitis that were far in excess of those that they had previously seen.
We're just at the end of the hour. Now, important point to make here is that Dr. Wakefield is not anti-vaccine. But what he is, he's pro-freedom. He's pro-freedom of choice. He supports parents' decision to maybe not give the kids a certain vaccine because they know something about it. That is central. Freedom is central. We're going to break. We'll be right back for hour two. Stay with us.